Blog Talk Radio.
Hi, this is Russ Terry, founder and CEO of Life Coach Radio Network. Today's sponsor is Audible.com, a leading provider of spoken audio entertainment and information. Listen to audiobooks whenever and wherever you want. Get a free audiobook when you sign up for a 30-day free trial at audibletrial.com/lifecoachradio. That's audibletrial.com/lifecoachradio. And now, here's today's show.
Hello, everyone. Today's guest is that iconic, adorably precocious, red-haired former child star of the 1970s, Mason Reese. I'm your host, Jan Jaffe. Welcome to Your Best Life. Mason Reese is a former child actor who appeared in numerous television commercials in the 1970s, particularly for Underwood Deviled Ham, It's a Borgeshmord, Post Raisin Bran, and Dunkin' Donuts, Dunkin' Munchkins brand donut holes. He was also a frequent guest on the Mike Douglas Show, appeared on the cover of TV Guide in December 1973, and played drums in several bands in the late 1980s. He was also part owner of several nightclubs and restaurants in New York City, including Paladar, Now Bar, Mason's, and Destination Bar. Mason now manages young singers and bands via his management company, Mason Reese Management. I'm so excited to have Mason Reese as my guest on today's show. Welcome, Mason.
Hello, Jan. I got to tell you, that lead up was so extensive, I don't have anything more to say.
I mean,
you covered everything, my Lord.
As I said, that will be a first if you have nothing more to say.
Well,
and
that
I think,
would be, but yeah, wow. I hope I can live up to all of that.
Oh, I think you can. And I think between the two of us, you and I always have a lot to say to each other.
Absolutely.
So first of all, I want to say, you know, what a treat it is to have you here on the show as a guest.
Thank you very much. Thank you.
And, you know, I just want to take a moment to express my deep and sincere condolences for the recent loss of your dad. I know that was...
Oh, thank you, Dan. Yeah. You know, I mean, he died at 85. He almost made it to May, which would have been his 86th. But he lived a great life. He really did. And he lived it on his terms, and he always was an adventurous guy. And... you know, as everyone says, I'm glad that his last few days were not painful. He was put into hospice. They took very good care of him. And, in fact, I leave on Friday to go to Arizona, which is where he lived for the last 5 years, I believe, and for his services. And thank you very much. That's very sweet of you.
Oh, well, thank you. The kind of the testimonial that you wrote about him in Facebook was really beautiful. Again,
it was very heartfelt, and you know, my father and I were very, very close, and we shared a very unique relationship, a really unique, loving bond. You know, when I was young, we would hold hands walking down the street. We were never afraid to give each other a hug and a kiss. We were very, very loving, and my whole family really, but. You know, my father was a very sensitive man. He cried quite a lot, which is where I think I get it from sometimes. But, I wanted to put some... I don't really talk about very personal things on Facebook. I usually try to keep it light and airy and easy-peasy. But I wanted to say something about my father, and I wanted to express some feelings about his life and my relationship with him. And I think I accomplished that.
You certainly did. Thank you so much. And, you know, I just wanted to invite our listeners to call in. We welcome your calls, questions, comments, and contribution to the discussion here. The number is 646-716-9397. We love your participation, so we'd love to hear from you again. Or if you just want to say hello to Mason. So the number again... The number again is 646-716-9397. 9397. So what most of the listening audience doesn't know is that you and I, Mason, have been friends for over 30 years. Can you believe
it? Hey. Oi.
Yeah, you've always lived in this neighborhood, right? And you grew up here,
yeah,
except
I
for that
on
one
the
little
west side, which is where
right,
I still live.
Right, except for that one
and,
stint when you were across
well,
town.
Yeah, I lived on the Upper East Side for 2 years, and I lived in L.A. for 1 year.
Mm-hmm.
In 1977, I lived in L.A. But I'm a New Yorker and I'm an Upper West Sider, and
mm-hmm.
I love the neighborhood and. I guess you had mentioned that we met when I was about 18. Is that
mm-hmm.
really true?
I think, yep.
Wow.
That's
about to be 33 years.
Oh, my gosh. Yeah, I know. It was slightly over 30, yeah.
Wow. That's amazing.
Yeah.
I did not realize it was that long.
Yeah, and I remember when you lived on the East Side, you used to call me. We would talk very frequently, and you'd call, and you were always complaining about how you did, about how unhappy you were.
Well, you know, the sad part was, and I hope I don't offend anybody in the process, but I actually really liked my apartment.
Oh.
I just didn't like where I was living.
Right.
You know, I liked the actual physical apartment itself. I enjoyed it very much. But
mm-hmm.
I just didn't like the neighborhood. And it was
right.
kind of one of those things where I found it last minute, and it was a very good deal, you know, rent-wise.
Mm-hmm.
And I did sign a 2-year lease, and quite honestly, from day one, I just really wasn't happy there.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I squeaked by, and I survived. But, yes, I'm sure I was quite unhappy, and I'm sure I complained quite a bit.
Well, I think you liked your apartment a lot. You just didn't like going downstairs and outside there.
I just didn't like the neighborhood. I found it to be very sterile and
exactly.
very cold. And you know, the Upper West Side is anything but. You know, it's
mm-hmm.
not sterile. It's not cold. It's very family oriented. It's very welcoming. And
it's a real neighborhood over here. And your mom,
really
whom I adore, your mom still lives nearby. In fact, she used to be an actress, right?
Yes. As a matter of fact, there was just a beautiful article in the New York Post about my mother, strangely enough.
Oh, wow.
You know, everyone refers to her as Mason Reese's mother, but maybe I'm going to be Sonia Darren's son, you know, at
uh-huh.
this rate, because she's getting a lot of press. My mother was in a very, very classic legendary movie called The Big Sleep with Humphrey Bogart.
Wow.
And my mother was the second female lead to Lauren Bacall. She played Agnes, who was the woman who ran the bookstore.
I remember Agnes.
Absolutely. That was my mom. And what happened was there are only two surviving people from that movie, my mother and another actress named Dorothy Malone, who ended up having quite a lucrative career. My mother did not. My mother really didn't do very much and really never, materialized into a well-known actress, except with the die-hard fans, you know, the people who really follow these kind of things. So, recently, it was the 70th anniversary of the movie. I mean, that's mind-boggling to think that, but it is.
Wow.
And they wanted to interview somebody. And the writer from the New York Post, a lovely man named Lou Luminick, who's the head of the film and critic department, actually reached out to me on Facebook. Because I guess on Wikipedia or IMDb or one of these other search engines, it is listed that I am her son. So
wow.
Lou reached out to me. Yeah, it's pretty crazy. Lou reached out to me and said, I hate to tell you this, but I'm not calling to speak to you. I'm actually calling to speak to your mom. And I said, well, Lou, let me see if my mom would be willing to do it, because my mom is kind of a very quiet person when it comes to stuff like that. She really doesn't like to talk about her early career, but she was willing to do a phone interview with Lou, and we got it done, and there was a beautiful half a page in the New York Post, and so my mom at the age of 91, and please don't get angry at me for revealing your age, Mom. But, you know, she's kind of getting like this crazy resurgence out of nowhere. It's kind of wacky.
That's fabulous. That is so, and I so love her. You know, I've seen her, I've met her so many times, and at each of, you know, at each of the your club openings, I know she was there for at least some of them.
Absolutely.
But I'm not, yeah,
absolutely.
She's an amazing woman, just so lovely. You know, I think most everyone who was around and at all aware in the 1970s remembers your Underwood deviled ham commercials, and
that was
it's
the
a Borgeschmord. Right?
Yeah, it's a Borgeschmord. Yeah, that was a big one.
Right. Would you mind telling us a little about that period in your life and how the word Borgeschmord came into being?
Well, I can definitely answer one of those questions. You know, the funny thing is, I know a lot of people in my life that can remember stories about their lives going all the way back to the age of 3, 4, whatever.
Mm-hmm.
I actually don't have the sharpest memories of particular days that I worked or commercials I worked on. I have a faint memory here, a faint memory there. I can tell you what life was like in general, but I cannot
mm-hmm.
necessarily tell you what it was like on the set the day of, you know? And I don't know why. I just don't have those vividly sharp, you know, memories of those days. But I can tell you, I do know about the word Borgeschmord. Okay. So, originally, in the script, it says it's like having a smorgasbord, or smorgasbord,
mm-hmm.
however the literal pronunciation is. And the advertising director at the time, who actually was directing the commercial too, wanted me to mispronounce the word. He didn't like it as it was written on the copy. He wanted something funny, something unique, something different. And Andy was his name, Andy Doyle. And Andy came up to me and said, Mason, I'd like to try something a little different. I'd like you to mispronounce the word smorgasbord. And I said, but Andy, I know what the word means. I know the real word, and I don't want America to think that I don't know what the word is. So... Yeah, no, I mean, I was a feisty little kid. So Andy, in his brilliance, decided that he was going to get it out of me no matter what. So he wrote down on a yellow pad of paper a dozen or so different ways to mispronounce the word. And one of them was Borgeschmord. So I picked out that one. So Andy looks at me in the eyes and says, Mason, you're not going to believe this. And I said, what, Andy, what? He goes, Borgeschmord is smorgasbord in Swedish. Which is an utter and complete lie. He was lying right to the face of a 6.5-year-old. But what it did psychologically was it made me actually feel smarter than I really was. So Andy Doyle got one over on me. Which
mm-hmm.
is what a good director is supposed to do, is supposed to get the best out of you, and ultimately got me to mispronounce the word, and quite frankly, I really believe that's what made the commercial.
Uh-huh.
That's really what made that commercial an iconic commercial. And that ran for 5 years, all over,
wow.
everywhere, and I won the Clio Award, which, for people who don't know, is like the commercial advertising version of the Oscar.
Mm-hmm.
It's called the Clio, and I won the Clio for the best actor in a commercial for that year.
I had not remembered that you had won the Clio, but I think everybody remembers, anybody who was at all conscious during that period of time remembers
yeah.
that commercial. And it was Borgeschmord, and the way you said
yes.
it, and it wasn't just
yes.
that it was, you were just the cutest little thing. You know,
well,
so so the combination of that and the way you said it's a Borgeschmord, I mean,
yeah.
But that's fantastic. What a great story. So you were 6.5?
Yeah, and it aired when I was 7.
God.
And, you know, it's just one of those things, you know, it kind of what I like to call a perfect storm, you know,
mm-hmm.
being at the right place at the right time with a unique look. I'd like to think I had a unique talent. So when you add all those things together, it, mm-hmm. it just worked. And I had done a bunch of commercials before that one, including, I believe, Post-Raisin Bran. I think I did that before Underwood, although I mm-hmm. could be wrong on the timing. But that was the one that really hit. That was the one that kind of was the mm-hmm. buzzword on the lips of Americans for years and years, and that's ultimately what brought me to, and here comes the segue, it brought me to The Eyes of Mike Douglas.
Mm-hmm.
You know, winning the Clio Award and that commercial being so popular brought me to the attention of the bookers for the Mike Douglas Show.
Mm-hmm.
And quite honestly, I owe everything to him. I mean, if it weren't for Mike and his unbelievable love and graciousness and you know, just really coddling my career and helping me, you know, I'm sure I would not have had the popularity that I was able to attain.
Mm. Well, I don't know. Borgeshmord really put you out there for
well,
at least in the yeah. you know, commercials. They play them so often, and that really, I think that was so instrumental in getting you out there in the first
place.
Well, that really.
Commercial was running, you know, 20 times a day in every city in the world.
Yeah.
And it was just over.
Right.
You know,
right.
They beat you over the head with it. But it mm-hmm. worked. I mean, it was highly successful
did.
For the Underwood Company. I ended up mm-hmm. doing a couple of more commercials for them for different products, chicken spread and liverwurst and a few things. And they were all very popular, but not like that one.
Mm-hmm.
So that was the one.
So let me ask you, before we get on to talking about Mike Douglas, how do you have any memory of how old you were when you started and how you even got involved in this?
Oh, absolutely. I started in the business when I was 4. There was a woman who lived in our building growing up over on West End Avenue who had a son that was not so much of an actor, but he did a lot of modeling and a lot of print work in magazines and newspapers, a little bit of acting. And at the age of 2, she basically confronted my mom and said, "Mason is absolutely adorable. You should get him involved in acting." And I had 3 older siblings that were 8, 9, and 10 years older than myself. So they were all, you know, still living at home. And the idea of carrying me under one arm and carrying a bag of diapers under the other and having 3 other kids to take care of was really an overwhelming thought to my mom, especially with her acting background. When she left the acting world, she was not particularly fond of it. You know, it didn't hold the greatest memories for her. So the lady kept on persisting over and over again until I was about 4 years old. And at that time, I was very verbal and very outgoing. And at that point in time, my mom brought up the idea to me. And I liked it. I thought it'd be interesting. It'd be an adventure, something fun to do. And I did 1 print ad, which aired in many local newspapers in New York for Kellogg's Corn Flakes. And then I literally went to my first audition for Ivory Snow Laundry Detergent. And
you
it
remember
was for,
this?
Oh, yeah.
You, oh,
was,
my goodness.
It was for Ivory Snow, and it was going to be a regional New York, New Jersey, and Pennsylvania commercial for their detergent. Well, what we didn't know was that at the age of 4, I was able to memorize a script backwards and forwards.
Wow.
Okay. I read the lines over and over a few times with my mom, and I memorized it, and that was it. And I ended up beating out 800 kids for the lead part. There
wow.
were other kids in the commercial, but I was the talking part of it. And
mm-hmm.
what they liked about me, I believe, was the fact that I was so verbal, but
mm-hmm.
so young-looking. I mean, I probably didn't even look like I was 4. I probably looked even younger. But I was so verbal and so outgoing that I landed the role. I ended up doing a couple of more commercials for Ivory Snow, one of which won another Clio for Best Product. And
wow.
that ultimately led to a couple of other commercials that I did. Nothing monumental. I did one for Thick and Frosty, which was like a chocolate milkshake kind of thing. And I think Post-Raisin Bran and a couple of others. Matchbox Fighting Furies and a bunch of others. But then I landed Underwood. And truth be told, after I landed Underwood and won the Clio that year, I never had to audition ever again.
Uh-huh.
That was it. My auditioning days were done. It now got to the point where either you wanted to hire Mason Reese or you didn't. And if you did, my agent was going to tell you what you were going to be paying me. It wasn't going to be scale, and it wasn't going to be like everybody else, because at that point in time, I was a proven commodity.
Mm-hmm.
And that was pretty incredible at the age of 7 to never have to audition ever again.
Wow, it sure was.
Yeah.
My goodness.
Yeah.
So, wow, that was, so your mother obviously was, and she had a new career, which was taking care of your career, pretty
much. Well, yeah, and that was no simple task.
Yeah.
I mean, there was, there were times when the demand was great, and it took a lot of time, and there was a lot of traveling involved. Luckily, though, again, and I don't want this to come across in any way, shape, or form as arrogant or flippant, but part of the deal was, again, if you wanted to hire me, we were going to shoot the commercial in New York.
Mm-hmm.
Because that's where I was based. And my mother and father did not want me to have to travel for a half a day, do a commercial, and come back the next day.
Mm-hmm.
They didn't want to put me through that kind of strain. So,
right. So how do you think that affected you? Did you know, from what you can remember at that time, growing up and being so young, what kind of effect do you think that had on you?
Well, you know, I think that the biggest issue for me was the fact that I was so instantly recognizable on the streets of New York.
Mm-hmm.
So I constantly had to be watched everywhere I went. I was never alone, ever. Even in later years, I wasn't allowed to walk outside really by myself. Wherever my mom or my father and I would go, or my brother, if he was the one watching me, we would literally get mobbed. I mean, people would surround me and, you know, ask me for autographs or want to give me a hug or whatever it may be. And it was quite overwhelming at times. And the truth be told, I never really fully comprehended why everybody was so happy to see me.
Mm-hmm.
You know, my attitude was, well, I'm just being me. I'm just doing what I do. You know, why is everyone, you know, want a piece of me, so to speak, you know? And so that was a little bit difficult for me to really understand and get a grip on. But the beauty of it was, is that I had very loving and supportive parents. And their attitude was very simple. We want you to be happy. This is going to be a roller coaster. We want you to enjoy the ride. But the day that you wake up, and it's no longer fun for you, and it's no longer an adventure, and it's no longer a roller coaster ride, that's the day that we walk away.
Mm-hmm.
That's the day that you stop, because it's not worth it to be doing something that makes you unhappy. Like, you know. And there did come a time much later on in my life when that did start to happen, but certainly not in the young years, not in the early years.
Mm-hmm.
But I would say that that was probably the thing that affected me single-handedly the most, was dealing with the crowds of people and not really understanding why. You know, I mean, I would do the Mike Douglas show in Philadelphia, and I would walk out the backstage door, and there would be 300-400 people there.
Wow.
And literally, I mean, they had to whisk me into the car, you know, to get me out of there. I mean, it was like a little mini Beatles kind of thing, you know, on a much smaller scale. But that's kind of how it felt, with the yelling and the screaming, and people wanted, you know, to grab me and pull up my hair and, you know, whatever else. So, you know, my mother and father were just very, very protective people.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they never wanted me to get a big head about it. They never talked about money with me.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we never discussed what kind of money I was earning. We never discussed privileges. You know, they wanted me to feel truly like a 7, 8, 9, 10, 12-year-old, whatever. And I think, in retrospect, that was probably pretty damn important.
Yeah, it certainly is. I mean, but were you able to have friends at that point when you were doing all of this?
Well, the thing was is that I never really identified, to be honest with you, I never identified with children.
Mm-hmm.
I always felt more comfortable in the company of adults because when you're on set, everybody's a lot older than you are. So,
right.
You know, the cameramen, the grips, the lighting people, makeup, hair, whatever it may be, the director,
mm-hmm.
they're all adults. And they treated me, in most cases, like an adult. You know, they didn't patronize me. They didn't talk down to me. They didn't pat me on the head. You
mm-hmm.
know, I had a job to do. I came in, and I was expected to do my job.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and do it on time and
right.
not cost them money to go over budget. So, you know, that was something that was very important. And, I mean, at the age of 7, I learned how to roll craps. You know, I learned how to play poker. I mean, you know, these are things that, you know, when you are taking a break on set, when you're taking lunch or whatever you're doing, you know, you just hang out with the grips and you hang out with the adults. So, truth of the matter is, when I would go back to school and they would be talking about history and algebra and mathematics and, you know, whatever, I would think to myself, well, I rode an elephant and was the ringmaster of the Barnum and Bailey Circus,
mm-hmm.
and I co-hosted the Mike Dudley Show for 3 weeks, and mm-hmm. I piloted the Goodyear blimp live on television. And
wow.
I'm taking a private VIP tour of the White House. Algebra is pretty damn boring.
Well, I would think so. You toured. When did you tour the White House?
When I was 7 or 8, Nixon was in office. As a matter
oh
of fact,
gosh.
I just missed him, literally. But I was in his office, and I actually got to sit behind Teddy Kennedy's office over at the. I guess it was the Senate, right? Yeah. And I actually sat behind his desk, and I put my feet up on his desk, and he walked in.
And what did he say?
Yeah, well, I don't remember the words, but I remember he
mm-hmm.
was unbelievably nice to me.
Aww.
I mean, just
well, you were
the
so
nicest
cute.
Man. Yeah, and he gave me an autographed picture, and, you know, just... But I did miss Nixon literally by moments. I don't know if people know, but there's actually an underground train that goes between the White House and the Senate. And it's like a little trolley car train, way underground. And I
wow.
rode on that. I got to ride on that. And, you know, I had my own private Secret Service agent taking me around. So, you know, when you do things like that, you
mm-hmm.
know, 2 + 2 = you know, A, B, C, doesn't exactly hold your attention.
Right.
You know,
right.
and consequently, I was not a good student in school.
Mm-hmm.
I really flaked out quite a bit on the times that I was there. And other than maybe a very, very small handful of younger people, I really never had a lot of friends.
Well, it sounds like you had a lot of friends in the business, and you were a very
right.
busy child.
Well, that's exactly
Absolutely.
Right. That's exactly
mm-hmm.
right. But I went to professional children's school, which
mm-hmm.
is a school that caters to young people who are in the performing arts, whether they are dancers at School of American Ballet or they are a violinist at Juilliard or an actor mm-hmm. in movies and television. They cater to all of those young people. Milton Berle went there. Brooke Shields went there. I mean, the list is endless
mm-hmm.
of who went there. And what they do is they tailor the curriculum to your schedule.
Mm-hmm.
So if you're literally gone for a month because you're on tour with a Broadway show, well, that's what they do. You know, I was never gone for that long, of course, but
mm-hmm.
there were times when I was out of school for days at a time, and I would make up the curriculum either at home or on, you know, whatever. So... It was pretty good. I mean, it's a good system. It definitely works.
It definitely is. Absolutely. Better
yeah.
than not, you know, not catering to you and giving, obviously, they gave you what you needed. You
right.
know, I just want to say that here on the Life Coach Radio Networks, we're proud to have as our sponsor Audible.com. Audible.com is the leading provider of premium digital spoken audio information and entertainment on the Internet. offering customers a new way to enhance and enrich their lives every day. Audible is the preeminent provider of spoken word audio products, which include more than 100,000 audio programs from more than 1,800 content providers. Receive a free audiobook with your 30-day trial when you sign up with Audible today at audibletrial.com/lifecoachradio. That's audibletrial.com/lifecoachradio. Now, here's an Audible book that's related to today's topic. You Look Like That Girl, A Child Actor Stops Pretending and Finally Grows Up, written and narrated by Lisa Jacob. So don't forget to sign up for a one-month free trial to get your free audiobook today at audibletrial.com/lifecoachradio. Audible.com, making listening a tool for life. And now back to our show. You know, I just wanted to remind...
Can I just say something about that? You know,
yeah.
When I was very young, I was an avid reader. Okay?
Mm-hmm.
I read a lot, especially in school, and I love to read. But I got to tell you, as I've gotten older, my attention span, my ability to read for long periods of time has really diminished. And I'm not exactly sure why. I don't have ADD. You know, I'm not obsessive compulsive where I have to go clean everything every 2 seconds. But my ability to actually put a book in my hands and really read it has definitely diminished as I've gotten older. And many, many people over the years have suggested that I go to audiobooks.
Well, here's a great opportunity.
Yeah, because it's something that you can listen to and absorb,
mm-hmm.
and you don't have to have the mental focus to read every little letter that's on the page. And also, I have to wear glasses now when I read, which happens to the best of us, of course. So maybe that's what makes it a little bit more difficult as well. So I would imagine that, you know, an audiobook would be ideal for anyone who kind of falls into that category.
Absolutely. I just want to remind our callers that we would love to hear from you. If you want to call in with a question, a comment, or just to say hello to Mason, the number here is 646-716-9397. Again, that's 646-716-9397. So getting back to the Mike Douglas Show, which you co-hosted, you said, for 3 weeks even.
Three separate weeks, yeah.
Yeah, and so I'm wondering who your favorite, I don't know if we'll call them co-guests on the Mike Douglas Show were. I know you were on one time with Leonard Nimoy.
I was on with Leonard Nimoy. Here's what happened, okay? Very briefly. I'll make a long story as short as I possibly can. So the very first time I did the Mike Douglas Show, I was a guest, and Ava Gabor was the co-host. So I had never done a national television show like that. And to be very honest with you, I was very, very scared backstage. And my father leaned down and said, "Mason, if you really don't want to do it, we won't do it. But I'll make you a bet." I mean, I don't even know what the bet was. It might have been a donut. Mm-hmm. It might have been something, you know. He goes, "I will make you a bet that within 1 minute, you are going to be comfortable and everything will be fine." And I went out there and I kicked butt. And they actually ended up bringing me back for a second 7-minute segment because I was, you know, doing so well. So as we were in the dressing room on the way back to the hotel, the lead talent booker, the main talent booker for the show, came back to my mother and father and said, "You know, Reese family, yes. Well, we'd like to discuss something with you. We'd like to run it by you and see how you feel about it. We would like Mason to co-host an entire week." Now, we're not talking about 14 minutes now. We're talking about 90 minutes, 5 shows in a row. Okay, my mother and father, literally, if I may say, probably crapped in their pants because I did not have a filter.
I know.
I did not have an on and off switch. Okay, so they were really worried what may come out of my mouth at any given moment.
And it was live, right? The shows were
No, it's not live.
Oh, they weren't live.
Not live.
Okay.
No, no. We did two shows on a Monday, one show on a Tuesday, and then two shows on a Wednesday. So we shot five shows in 3 days. I would say they were probably done about 3 weeks ahead of when they aired, something like that. But they were in front of a live audience.
Mm-hmm.
That they were. I mean, there was a 300-person audience there. So they agreed to do it. Now, what the producers did was they wanted to fill 90 minutes with as many subject matters and guests as they possibly could that would keep Little Mason Reese entertained. Okay? So they had to always put in one guest that was kind of topical news, you know, like that might not really appeal to me so much, you know. But, yes, they brought on magicians. They brought on musical guests. They brought on, you know, they made me an honorary, you know, Philadelphia police captain. They let me drive the train in Philadelphia. You know, they put me on the Goodyear blimp. So they were constantly doing things that they thought would keep me for 90 minutes, almost like a trained dog, really, you know, in some ways, to keep me happy and focused. And I was a huge lover of two shows back in the day. I loved Star Trek, and I loved Mission Impossible. Those were two of my favorite shows on television. They were great shows. Well, Peter Lupus, who was the strong man on Mission Impossible, the big guy, okay, he came on and literally bench-pressed me over his head. So that was pretty fun. And then, of course, yes, one of the greatest clips, one of the greatest people I had on the show was Leonard Nimoy. And I was so enamored with him, you know. And while I understood that the show wasn't real, I was so fascinated with the technical aspect of it. Like, well, how did the ship really fly? And how did the lights really light up on the boards? And what, you know? And he was so patient with me and so sweet and understanding of the fact that I was an innocent little kid, you know, but yet a very advanced innocent little kid.
Right.
So he answered the questions as an adult, but in a very simple and loving way. So, yeah, that's
it's an adorable clip. It's an absolutely adorable clip.
Yeah, and how cool was the suit?
I don't know. The suit almost made me blind.
I like the suit. I thought the suit was pretty cool. For those who don't know, he was basically wearing an entire suit made out of blue jeans, but like patchwork blue jeans.
Yeah, that was, you know, I mean, this was, this was this the 70s? How old were you, or what year was, do you know, remember when this was?
By the way, I don't know if you moved locations, but the phone is starting to have a little sound issue.
Ah, no.
Now it's fine.
Okay, thank you.
I was seven. So we're talking 1972.
Oh, my God. Well, okay, so back then people wore different sorts of things.
Oh, yeah. But Leonard was a very flashy guy. He was a very hip guy, you know.
Yes, he was.
He was like a hip, swinging kind of cool cat, you know. And just one of the nicest guys. But that was the whole goal of the show, was for 90 minutes to keep me as busy as possible.
And there was wasn't there some musical guest that?
There were tons of them. I mean,
but there was one that made you. Did they make you cry or something?
Well, that was Harry Chapin. That was Harry Chapin. You know, I've always been a very sensitive person, and there are times when, as a child, things would affect me, and no one could understand why. No one got it. No one was inside my brain and could understand why this small little thing, seemingly insignificant, would affect me and make me cry. And he had just done, you know, a very big hit song, I'm sure everyone knows, Cats in the Cradle. And Cats in the Cradle, if you listen to it lyrically, is a very poignant, beautiful song.
So at 7 years old, you were listening carefully to the lyrics. Most of us at that age can barely make out the words. We just hear sounds and we hear music,
yes.
And there you were. So to say you were advanced is kind of that's an understatement.
Well, also at the age of seven, I was analyzed with a third-year college reading level at that point. So I definitely was not the norm, you know.
No, you were definitely
kind of
not.
An offbeat little guy. So Harry Chapin was booked to appear on the show. And that song, Cats in the Cradle, always made me cry. And to this day, I'm not exactly sure why, because the storyline of the song is about a young boy who doesn't really have a relationship with his father, that his father is always too busy for him. And then it turns a 180 where he becomes too busy for the father. And that never happened with me and my father.
Mm-hmm.
My father was never too busy to spend time
Aww.
With me and to
but
be
maybe
loving
you
with
felt,
me.
Maybe you felt some empathy, you know, and compassion
for
the character in the song. Oh, that's
I believe
so
I did. So,
you know, I'm sorry, go on.
No, I was just going to say, what happened was is that Harry did the show, and I asked him before the show, are you going to do Cats in the Cradle? And he said, no, I'm going to do something else. And then when Mike introduced Harry, he said, ladies and gentlemen, Harry Chapin singing his hit song, Cats in the Cradle.
Oh, my.
And I literally broke down with cameras and 300 people in the audience, and I started sobbing.
Aww.
And the last 30 minutes of the show, they actually had to do the show without me.
Really?
Because I walked off the show. You
oh,
know?
My goodness.
And they just, you know, played it off as though, you know, Mason takes that song very personally and, you know, he'll be back tomorrow, you know, that kind of thing.
Wow.
You know, and Mike was very loving about it and very supportive, and it was not a problem. You know, they worked around it, but the song had a lot of meaning to me.
Well, you were 7 years old too. Oh my God,
yeah.
How sweet!
Yeah.
What a sweet story. So
yeah.
You know, let's move on. I know that you played drums in the 80s with some bands. Do you have any favorite memories?
Well, you know, drums. I started playing when I was about 14. And I never had aspirations to become a famous rock and roll drummer. That wasn't my desire. It was more so something that made my heart feel good, you know, that I was able to pound on the drums and, you know, play great songs and things like that. And I was fortunate enough in 87, 88, 89 to be hanging out with a lot of incredibly talented musicians, people that had toured all over the world. You know, I played with David Letterman's horn players, and I played with Phoebe Snow's keyboard player. I mean, I got to play with a lot of really incredible people. And we played a lot of clubs around New York City. And again, it wasn't about the money. It wasn't about the fame. We just played to have fun. And
that's great.
That was something that, quite honestly, I miss. I would love to do that again. You know, it's not easy to round up a couple of guys and play anymore. There's not many live music venues in New York City anymore, and all my friends have gone on to much bigger and better, and they're just not available. So, you know, but like I said, it was never anything that I dreamt of being a multi-million platinum-selling artist. I really just did it to make my heart feel good.
Oh, that's great.
Yeah.
What people may not know, unless they're quite local, is that you owned several restaurants and nightclubs in the years that I've known you. And, in fact, you invited me to the openings for all of them.
Yes.
So I'm curious, what made you decide to become involved in that line of work?
Well, as my career was starting to fizzle when I was about 16, 17, it really became apparent to me that the knocking on the door was becoming much less frequent. So, growing up in New York City in the early 80s, which I'm sure you will remember quite fondly, was, you know, a very pivotal time in New York. And New York nightlife was booming, you know, the nightlife scene, the nightclubs and things like that. And although I can proudly declare I've never had a drink in my life. I've never smoked a cigarette. I've never smoked pot. The only drugs I've ever done in my entire life were in a hospital after I hurt my leg one time. So I live a very, very straight life when it comes to that, okay?
But very clean, yes.
Yeah, very clean. I don't eat so well. I need to lose a few pounds, but that's a subject for another time. the bottom line is, though, I wanted to experience New York nightlife. I wanted to go out, and I wanted to see what it was all about. And to be, again, not sound arrogant or flippant, I was still very, very famous at that point. So every nightclub I went to, every lounge, every bar, every club, literally it was like when I walked up to the door, it was like parting the Red Sea. You know, everybody moved out of the way. Every doorman knew who I was. You know, every famous club, you know, wanted me to come to their club. And the Velvet Rope opened, and they ushered me to a VIP table, and it was really quite an incredible experience for me. So, again, to make a long story short, as much, as short as I can, I realized after a number of years that I actually enjoyed New York nightlife, that I really kind of, I understood it for what it was. I was starting to understand the dynamics of it, the financial part of it, and I literally became a sponge. And I observed, and I watched, and I listened. And I decided at the age of 30, back in 1995, that I wanted to open up my very first nightclub. I felt it was something instinctively that I would be good at. I'm good with numbers, I'm creative, and I'm good with people for the most part. And there you go.
Ah,
in 1995, I opened up the Now Bar, and we remember. Lasted 10 years. We were there for 10 years.
Wow, that was the old Mars Bar, right?
No, that wasn't the Mars Bar.
Which one?
The Milk Bar.
Excuse me. Mars Bar was further down. Yeah, Milk Bar,
yeah,
right.
Mars Bar was over in the Meatpacking District of Manhattan.
That was a fun place,
and
too.
That was a fun place. That was pretty crazy. Yeah, we were the old Milk Bar that had been closed for many years by the time we got there. And, you know, we gutted it, renovated it, turned the downstairs into kind of like a grotto cave kind of a feel with a little waterfall in the back and the whole thing. And we had a pretty good 10-year run, you know.
Absolutely.
And then I opened up Paladar, which is a great Latin fusion restaurant in the East Village. And
great food, too.
Fantastic food. I love that place. The food was phenomenal, and we got a lot of acclaim, and New York Magazine ranked us top 100 in all of New York, and, you know, Time Out New York voted us best new Lower East Side restaurant. So we had a good run there, too, and we were there for about 11 and a half years. Destination Bar, which is my last place, was just sold a year ago, but I was there for 5.5 years. And to be honest with you, Jam, I'm done.
Yeah. That's a hard business. That's a really tough business.
I did 20 years in the nightlife business in New York City, and I'm tired. And the truth of the matter is that it really is a business for the young.
Yeah.
It really truly is.
It's tough. It's a really tough business.
Yeah, it's a real grind. It really truly is. And the truth of the matter is, it's not the way it was back in the 80s and 90s.
Everything has changed with our economy.
New York City has changed. It's a very different
The town
is very different in a lot of ways. And unfortunately, what that means is that a lot of the creativity and a lot of the uniqueness of nightlife has also disappeared. And
I'm going to interrupt you.
Yeah.
I'm going to interrupt because I really want, there's so much more I want. We're running out of time, and there's a couple of other things I really want to hit on. So I really want to talk about, just briefly touch on the pilot that you recently completed, and you had a very interesting cast. So would you mind quickly telling our listening audience a little?
This relates back to what I said before about the door, you know, no one knocking at the door, okay? So what do you do when no one knocks at the door? Well, what you do is you create your own door, okay? So I contacted a very good friend of mine, Stephen Wishnoff, who was a former producer at TV Land. And I said to Stephen, Stephen, I want to get back in front of the public eye. What do you think we should do? And Stephen said, well, we need to form a production company, which we did. What is the name of that company? Borgeswarde Productions. So there you go. A little homage to the old days, okay?
Right.
And what we did was he wrote and created a fantastic 30-minute sitcom. And a year ago, January, I went out to L.A. for 5 weeks, and we shot a pilot for the show. Now, the show is very much an old-fashioned kind of sitcom with very fast pacing. It's what they call a single-camera sitcom, so there's no live audience. Shot very much like a film, but in a very fast, snappy pace, okay? The show has a lot of actors in the show, which a lot of the older listening audience would absolutely identify with. We have Allison Arngrim, who played Little Nellie on Little House on the Prairie. We have Dawn Wells, who played Marianne from Gilligan's Island. We have Erin Murphy, who played Tabitha on Bewitched. We have Michael Learned, who is the mother on The Waltons. We also have Robbie Rist, who played Cousin Oliver on The Brady Bunch. We have Brandon Cruz, who played Eddie on Courtship of Eddie's Father. So these are all people that are involved in the pilot and will be regular guest stars if we sell the show. And it's a very modern sitcom, but with a lot of really recognizable classic sitcom actors.
Fantastic. So tell me, you said there was something new that happened?
News? What we're going to do is we are actually going to create our own YouTube channel called Smart Productions on YouTube, and we are going to do 5 episodes, approximately 4 minutes each, as little teasers, one that will lead into the next. So when you see number 2, it will say, on last week's episode, you know, that kind
Fantastic.
Of thing.
Fantastic.
And what we're going to do is we're going to create the buzz that way, and then we are going to submit ourselves to all of the festivals that are out in the country that have to do with what they call web series. And ultimately, the ultimate dream is to be picked up by a network, obviously, and then convert from a web series into a full, you know, 22-minute actual sitcom.
Oh, that
you know.
Sounds so exciting. What a great, great idea. So tell me, what projects are you working on now?
Well, the other thing I did, Jan, is that I love young performers. I always have. I always feel a kinship with them. So that and my love of music combined, I opened up about a little less than a year ago, I created Mason Reese Management. And Mason Reese Management is a small little boutique management agency that works with young singers and young bands. We have people from New Jersey. We have people from San Antonio, Texas. I literally just flew back from Boca Raton, Florida, where I worked with this incredible 14-year-old rock and roll singer-guitar player, funny enough, whose name is Mason Pace.
Uh-huh.
So I love the first name. Gotta love it. So we went in the studio. We recorded an incredible slamming rock and roll tune. Now we're going to put a press kit together, and we're going to try to get the kid a record deal. So,
that's so exciting,
that's
really Mason Reese Management.
MasonReeseManagement.com. So anybody can go on there, see what the team that I put together, who we're working with. You know, we're still a small agency. We only have 4 people right now on the roster, but we are growing, and we're going to try to promote young people and try to help them attain their dreams and their goals.
That's very exciting.
It really is exciting. You know, it's something very different for me. I don't think I ever envisioned, you know, going on the other side of the table, you know, on the professional side of things. I don't think I ever envisioned that. But it's challenging, sometimes a little frustrating, but truthfully, very exciting. And ultimately, I believe, very rewarding.
That's great. So let me ask you this. As a former child star, why do you think, and we touched on this a little bit before, but I want to know why you think other former child stars have difficulties such as with drugs and alcohol and the law as they get older, as they grow up. You know, you haven't.
No, I have not.
You don't drink, you don't do drugs, and I've known you for more than half your life. And I can speak for that. Whenever you were in a bar or anything, you're sipping on a Diet Coke.
Exactly. So. Right. And back in the day, it was Tab, if you remember.
Oh, right.
I jokingly tell people I was literally breastfed on Tab.
How hilarious.
I mean, literally.
But why do you think that is, though, seriously, why other child porn stars?
Let me just tell you from my vantage point only about me,
sure.
And then I'll answer the other part of it very quickly.
Okay.
In my case, I had two incredibly loving and supportive parents that were there every step of the formative years of my life. Now, neither one of them were drinkers. I think my father, maybe in his heyday, had 5 beers a year.
Wow.
I mean, just never drank, not a drinker. My mother always lived a healthy lifestyle, never even has tasted coffee in her life.
Oh, wow.
Okay? Now, that's just me, okay? Now, let me address the other part very quickly. Okay, we all know who the cast of characters are. We all know who the usual suspects are. We know the actors that have gotten in trouble. I'm not even going to mention names. Don't even need to. Because we write about them. We know who they are. But I will say one thing. If you look at a cross-section of America, there are always kids getting in trouble with drinking and drugs. There are always kids getting arrested for doing stupid things. The problem is they never get put in the newspaper.
All right.
They never get any attention paid on them. Okay, pay to them. The truth of the matter is, Jim, if you take all of the actors over the last generations, the truth of the matter is it's an incredibly small percentage of them that get in trouble. But because when they do get in trouble, they are showcased and put up on a pedestal and have a spotlight, you know, shone on them, if that's the correct word. All of a sudden everyone says, oh my God, look what's happening to the child actor. They're all falling apart.
Absolutely. You know, I don't want to interrupt you. You know, I love the point that you made, but we all of a sudden we have two callers.
Oh, wow. Okay.
So, and we're getting to the end. We're probably going to run a little over, but I'd love to get them in. So,
well, that's beautiful. Great.
Yeah. So, caller, your number ends in 1017. Hello?
Hi, how are you?
I'm good.
Oh,
how are you? What's your name?
I know who this is.
I'm just calling in to say hello to a friend of mine, Mason Reese.
well, hello, Cynthia Smith.
Well, hello. I guess you know my phone number.
I most certainly do.
Gee, I just wanted to call and say hello and see how it was going for you. And
yes,
it was a pleasure listening to what I got to hear.
Well, thank you, Jan. This is Cynthia Smith, who is a very integral part of Masonry's management, and we are working very hard to do all the things that we talked about, to work with these young talented people, and to help them reach their goals.
That's fantastic!
Exactly.
It's so nice to speak with you, Cynthia.
It's a pleasure to meet you, Jan. Such a nice show you have here. I'm sorry I couldn't be here for most of it, because actually I am at a venue right now with one of our talent that we're representing at Mason Reese Management, who's just rocking the house here at the Dubliner in Boca Raton, Florida. We're having a great time. And I just thought I'd call in for a second because he's got a break. And I just wanted to say hello and see how it's going.
Oh,
well, thank
cool.
you so much for calling. It sounds like fun down there.
Cynthia, I can guarantee you Cynthia doesn't have any questions for me.
No,
okay.
I don't, but I just wanted to call in and say hi and just let you know everything's going pretty well here. And,
that's great.
Wanted to wish you to see how you're doing on the show tonight. And hello, Jan.
Nice to meet you as well. We're doing great.
Nice meeting you too, Cynthia. Thank you so much for calling.
You're very welcome. We'll talk soon. And, Jan, pleasure to meet you. Have a wonderful night. Just
wanted
to say hello.
Thank you.
Stop by and saying hi. That's all I wanted to do.
Okay,
hon. Bye-bye.
Thank you.
Bye-bye. Bye.
Well, that was nice.
Yes, that was. And
Cynthia lives in Boca Raton, and that's where one of our artists is. So he is actually playing a gig as we speak, and she's there in support of him, and that's very cool. Great.
great. And now we have another caller. Your number ends in 4132. Hello, are you there, caller? I think we may have lost the caller. Hello, 4132. I think we lost the caller.
Oh,
I'm going to mute the caller, and I'll see if we can bring them back. In the meantime, I have another question for you.
Yes.
And I was wondering, what advice would the Mason Reese of today give the Mason Reese of 1973 or thereabouts?
Mm. Wow.
Mm.
Okay. A lot of parents do come up to me and ask me for advice, and the truth of the matter is I started at the age of 4, okay?
Mm-hmm.
I would not necessarily recommend that.
Mm-hmm.
I would recommend to wait until a little bit later, maybe 7 or 8, when the child does have a little bit more of a comprehension about what they're actually doing.
Mm-hmm.
And I was a unique 4-year-old. Maybe there are a lot of other unique 4-year-olds, but the truth of the matter is that I would just say that you need to have a thick skin. You need to understand that you're not always going to get a yes. More than likely, you're going to get a bunch of no's before you ever get your first yes. That it may at times seem like you're banging your head into a wall. But the truth of the matter is, if you believe in your abilities and you believe in what you have to offer, that ultimately you will succeed, that things will be okay. I would also recommend that they do have a fallback in life, that they do go to school, that they do not depend on show business as their number one source of income, to learn a trade, to do something. I was a very rare breed, Jan. And I know a lot of child actors that I've gotten to know over the last few years. And my experience, to be very honest with you, is uniquely different to theirs.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they went through a lot more struggles than I have. And, they're very, very close to me. And we're a tight-knit little group. And they've told me about some of the horror stories that have happened to some of them. Everything from the parents stealing their money to some drugs and alcohol. And while I am incredibly passionate and sympathetic and empathetic, I do not identify with it. So I had a very unique life growing up. And I would say to a young actor who's looking to get in the business, have the most fun you possibly can. Create the whole thing and treat it like it's an adventure. Enjoy every moment of it, but don't let the no's and the rejection get you down, because it's going to happen. You are going to get rejected. And if you can survive that, you will thrive and you will be okay. And I think that would probably be the number one thing that I would preach to any young person looking to, enter the business.
Great advice.
Yeah.
Really great advice. And I mean, if I could add to that, just having myself been a performer, not as a child, but pretty young, even so, and the rejection is really hard, and to not, rejection is part of the game, and to not let it define you. That a rejection doesn't mean that you're terrible. It's a total rejection of you. You just may not be right for the part, or whoever is sitting there doing the auditioning, you may remind them of someone they don't like. You know, it's right. And
by the way,
that's what's so hard.
I want to say one more thing, and this is geared towards the parents. Okay.
Mm-hmm.
If you are attempting to put in your child into the business, so you can live through them, through their accomplishments, because maybe you're a frustrated actor that never, got to make it. And if you're attempting to make your child a star so you can live vicariously through them, then stop. Just stop it now. Don't even attempt to do that, because that will never end well.
Great advice. Thank you so much for that, Mason. Absolutely.
Oh, thank you, Jen.
You know, I cannot believe the time has just flown by, and
it has.
I mean, it's already after 9. So this has been such a wonderful and informative show.
Thank you. I really appreciate you asking me to do it.
Oh, it was a delight, and I just want to thank you, Mason, for being on the show today. It's been a real delight for me. I'm Jan Jaffe, and it has been my privilege to have been your host this evening. I'd like to offer our listeners a free 30-minute discovery and strategy session, and for more information, you can always email me at info@forwardtosuccess.com. You're invited to share any comments or feedback on our website, Life Coach Radio Networks. In addition to my solo interview show, I also host Think Tank, a roundtable discussion, and I would be delighted if you would join us for the next episode of Think Tank on March 23rd at 12 noon Eastern. Mason, would you care to share any closing thoughts or comments or website or book or contact information with our listening audience?
Well, I mean, I'm on Facebook, Mason Reese. I'm on Facebook. I'm also on Twitter under Mason Reese, MGMT. That's an abbreviation for management. And BorgesMoorProductions.com. That's it.
Fabulous. Thank you so much, Mason. And
thank you, Jim,
being on the show today. I have so enjoyed having you with us, and it has been such a treat for me.
Thank you, me too.
Oh, great. And I want to remind our listeners that all of our contact and bio information is listed in today's show description. Now, I'm just going to take a moment to announce a few of our upcoming shows. On this, the Life Coach Radio Network, on March 19th at 10 a.m., The Audacity to Shine. On March 21st at 9 p.m., Courage to Climb. And on March 23rd at 12 noon, Think Tank, The Integral Nature of Anger. And on our sister network, the Life Coach Chat Channel, on March 14th at 7 p.m., Married After 30, Debunking the Elusive Marriage Myth for Women in Their 30s and 40s. So I again want to thank my wonderful friend and guest, Mason Reese, for joining me this evening and making this show a very, very special one. Thank you for listening. Goodbye.